This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. A second vessel loaded with aid for Gaza is getting ready to leave a port in Cyprus. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Cyprus's foreign minister says the ship will leave once another vessel, now at sea, reaches Gaza in coming days and offloads some 200 tons of food. This shipment will be far bigger.
Almost 400 tons, 400 pallets.
At a warehouse in Cyprus, the World Food Kitchen's Juan Camilo Jimenez watched crews pack the pallets. Attach labels reading humanitarian aid in both English and Arabic, and load them onto trucks before the eventual sea crossing. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The U.S.-based charity group Rural Central Kitchen said on Wednesday it was confident the ship carrying aid will get to residents in Gaza.
So work continues on the jetty. We're working on it 24/7. And so we are confident that when the aid gets to Gaza, there will be a way to offload it and get into the hands of Gazans who are starving and need this food aid urgently.
That was Linda Roth, Chief Communications Officer with WCK, speaking to reporters after a charity ship sailed out of Cyprus on Tuesday, towing a barge containing flour, rice, and protein. The mission was funded mostly by the United Arab Emirates and organized by WCK. The timing of the ship's arrival in Gaza remains unclear. The U.S. Central Command said Iranian-backed Houthi militants fired one anti-ship ballistic missile from Yemen into the Gulf of Aden Thursday, but said it caused no damage to any vessels. CENTCOM said its forces successfully engaged and destroyed four unmanned aerial systems and one surface-to-air missile in Houthi-controlled areas of Yemen, as they posed an imminent threat to merchant vessels and U.S. Navy ships in the region. This is VOA News. Houthi militants have repeatedly launched drones and missiles against international commercial shipping in the Gulf of Aden since mid-November, claiming they are acting in solidarity with Palestinians against Israel's military actions in Gaza. The Red Sea attacks have disrupted global shipping, forcing firms to reroute to longer and more expensive journeys around southern Africa. EU member states on Wednesday agreed to add $5.5 billion to a central fund to pay for weapons sent to Ukraine. The move provides a welcome boost for Kyiv as support from its other major backer, the United States, wavers, and its outgunned forces struggle to hold back Russia. The judge overseeing the 2020 election interference case in the southern U.S. state of Georgia has dismissed six of the charges in the indictment, including three against former President Donald Trump. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
John Acevedo at the Emory University School of Law explains why.
There is more than enough facts alleged in the indictment, but the district attorney forgot to state which law was being violated.
The order does leave many other charges intact, including 10 counts against Trump, and Acevedo says the ruling does not necessarily kill the case.
It's a small error, and it's something that can be remedied, but it's going to cause quite a bit of delay. Fannie Willis will either have to go back, amend these charges, re-have them indicted on them, and then proceed, which will cause quite a bit of delay, or she'll have to appeal.
And Acevedo calls it sloppy work on a high-profile case.
Which makes you think everyone would have, you know, crossed their T's and dotted their I's.
I'm Ben Thomas.
Police in Nigeria have ordered the creation of a new base for officers and the deployment of special forces in a remote village in northwest Kaduna State, where nearly 300 school students were abducted last week. Timothy Obezu reports from Abuja.
Last Thursday, armed bandits on motorbikes invaded an elementary school in the village of Kuriga in Kaduna State and abducted 287 school students, the highest single abduction of students in years. Days after the attack, in a separate incident, bandits kidnapped 61 people from Kajuru District, about 150 kilometers away. The new police base will be in Kuriga and deployment of extra officers to the area has begun. Timothy Obizu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Follow us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at voanews.com, as well as on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and X, formerly known as Twitter, and download our VOA News app. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, March 14th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria orders the creation of a police station in a remote community after man's kidnapping there.
We are launching the Special Intervention Squad for Kaduna State to give confidence to the people. The men will be deployed. I'm sure that the community will start to feel safe again.
South Africa, already plagued by an ongoing electricity crisis, is now hit by water shortages. Guinea's military government announces a 29-member cabinet. A terrorist group, Al-Shabaab, uses websites and social media accounts to operate. A Rwandan court disqualified opposition leader Victoire Ingabire from participating in the July 2024 presidential election.
I am disappointed because the judge took his decision on the basis of presidential decree that ordered my release in 2018. However, the constitution allowed me to participate in the election.
And the U.S. House of Representatives passes a bill Wednesday that would force TikTok to separate from its Chinese owner. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Police in Nigeria have ordered the creation of a new base for officers and the deployment of special forces in a remote village in northwest Kaduna State, where nearly 300 school students were abducted by armed bandits last Thursday. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Nigerian police chief, Kayode Egbetokun, announced plans for the new base and for deployment during a visit with Kaduna Governor Uba Sani on Tuesday. He said the steps will help restore residents' confidence in their safety while security forces continue the search for the missing students. Last Thursday, armed bandits on motorbikes invaded an elementary school in the village of Kuriga in Kaduna State and abducted 287 school students, the highest single abduction of students in years. Days after the attack, in a separate incident, bandits kidnapped 61 people from Kajuru District, about 150 kilometers away. The new police base will be in Kuriga and deployment of extra officers to the area has begun. Egbetofo says authorities are working to secure the abductees' release.
We are launching the Special Intervention Squad for Kaduna State, if only to give confidence to the people. The men will be deployed. And with the support that you have pledged to give, I'm sure that the community will start to feel safe again.
Governor Sani is hopeful the police operations will be successful.
We are extremely confident that the school children, by the grace of God, will come back completely. And I'm also happy with the decision by the Strabane police to quickly deploy movement base in our Kuriga community.
Last week, local media reported more than 300 women and children were kidnapped in northeastern Borno State by Islamic militants while they were gathering firewood. Insecurity is a major challenge for President Bola Tinubu, who launched an initiative called Renewed Hope after assuming office last May. The recent kidnappings are blamed in part on the absence of security forces in those remote areas. Last month, the president met with all 36 state governors to discuss decentralizing Nigeria's police force and creating a police arm for each state. Analyst Kabiru Adamu of Beacon Security says, if organized properly, this could be a step in the right direction.
There are gaps within the security architecture. This, I'm supportive of the decentralization of policing. But I think what we need more than anything is accountability. So that by the time we create the state for police, that accountability element that has been created at the federal level will trickle down to the state level.
Years of fighting Islamist militants and crime gangs have stretched Nigerian security forces thin. Many are hoping the creation of new bases and state police arms will help keep the kidnappers away. Timothy Obizu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigeria's president has ordered security forces not to pay a ransom for the release of more than 250 school pupils seized by government last week, the country's information minister said on Wednesday. According to the French news agency AFP, relatives say the kidnappers have demanded a large payment for the return of the students abducted from their school in Kuriga village in northwestern Kaduna state on Thursday. Guinea's military government on Wednesday evening announced a 29-member cabinet nearly a month after junta leader Colonel Mamadou Doumbouya abruptly dissolved the government. Daouda Mohamed Camara is editor-in-chief of At Espars FM. He tells me the new administration includes some old and new faces, including four women.
Let me tell you, James, we must start by saying that the 29 ministers, according to the structure of the government, we are appointed this evening. Of the 29 ministers, 16 are new and 7 have changed their department, and the others have been confirmed in their position. As for the minister women, let me say, we only have 4 women in this government. 2 are new and 2 are old for the last government.
At the same time, the new prime minister has been speaking about when the country can return to democratic rule. What did he have to say?
Indeed, the prime minister, Amadou Ouriba, said this during an interview he gave to our colleagues at RFI. That was on Tuesday. For him, it's not at all possible to hold all the elections this year, 2024. According to him, only the referendum can be held this year. And for the purpose, notably the presidential election, they can't, and if they can do it, all goes well, be held in 2025.
What does this new timetable mean now in terms of what ECOWAS wants?
Yes, that's the question everyone is asking today, because the engagement that they're speaking with the ECOWAS is to end the transition at the end of this year, 2024. But this announcement from the Prime Minister can take us to the question to know what are these years of trade with the ECOWAS, if there is any new negotiation between the two institutions, let me say CNRD in Guinea and the ECOWAS members. For the moment, no response to that question. And the Prime Minister Bawuri was saying that they will come on and see the ECOWAS and explain what is going on in Guinea today. If really they can understand that the election can be held this year or next year. That's the question all people are asking today. And we think maybe the next week and or the weeks coming, we'll see what the ECOWAS will give as a response to this announcement.
Daouda Mohamed Camara is the editor-in-chief at Espars FM. He was speaking with us from Guinea's capital, Conakry. Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire says she longs for a country where there is separation of powers between the branches of government, particularly an independent judiciary. This comes after a court on Wednesday disqualified her from participating in the July 2024 presidential elections. The court said Ingabire was not eligible because of a previous conviction. According to Reuters, Ingabire spent 8 years in prison for allegedly sowing division about Rwanda's 1994 genocide before President Paul Kagame pardoned her in 2018. She tells me Rwandan courts are not independent.
I am disappointed because the judge took his decision on the basis of a presidential decree that ordered my release in 2018. However, the organic law and the constitution allow me to be rehabilitated and to participate in the elections. Not only elections, also to leave my country. You know, since I was released, I have no right to leave the country. And my family lives in Holland, especially my husband is very sick. I wanted to visit him, and I asked many times the authorization to visit him. The authority refused me to give the authorization. I hoped that with the decision of the court, I can visit him, but today, the court rejected my request.
Comment on the fact that you are being pardoned by President Kagame.
Yes, I am pardoned, but as I said, if you take a look in the constitution and the organic law should have more weight than the decree. Even if it is a presidential decree, the judge has to consider the organic law, because the organic law stipulates that if you are released after 5 years, you can ask the rehabilitation.
What do you see as the future? Because the judge said you can appeal. Are you hopeful?
I cannot make any appeals to be rehabilitated except after 2 years. But I am still looking at the option with my lawyers if maybe we can appeal to the East African Court. But today, on my case shows there is no chance for a genuine opposition in Rwanda. The decision shows that the political space remains restricted to those who do not toe the line of the ruling party.
But we know that the Green Party leader, Frank Habineza, is allowed to participate.
Of course, he is allowed to participate, but he is not free to express himself. I can take example. I remember one day he proposed that the Rwanda government should have dialogue with his opponent. And the next day, the ruling party was asked him to demand a pardon publicly because only he asked the government to discuss with the opposition. This is not the kind of opposition I wanted to lead in my country. I wanted to build the opposition where people can express freely their mind, where people can have or decide with the decision policy making made by the government, that the people can be involved. So that the ruling party will ask everybody to follow what they deduct to the people.
You have been quoted, madam, as saying that the court decision is a reminder of the barrier to political participation and the urgent need for reform in governance in Rwanda. What type of reforms would you like to see happen?
The reform we need that should be happen is that we can have democratic institution, and that the judicial system can be free and independent, and that the judge will not be afraid to take a decision that can be against the presidential decree, that the parliament should be free to express themselves, that the parliamentarians are there to control the executive power. So the separation of the power, that is this kind of reform of governance we need in Rwanda. And secondly is that to establish the rule of law, that everybody can respect the laws that we have in our country. Because today, if we take example, the judges violated the constitution and the organic law that allow me to be rehabilitated.
Madam Ingabire, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
You're welcome.
Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Martin, Washington. Today is Thursday, March 14. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Parts of Africa's richest city, Johannesburg, have been without water or experiencing severe water shortages for nearly 2 weeks. As Kate Butler reports, blame is being placed on the local government and aging infrastructure.
Residents of South Africa's business hub, Johannesburg, are voicing anger over water shortages that have hit the city in the middle of a summer heat wave. Officials said some 50% of Johannesburg water's supply area has been affected by the shortages that have lasted nearly 2 weeks. Johannesburg has a population of almost 6 million people. There have been small protests by residents over the shortages, businesses have been hit hard, and several hospitals also have been affected. Nurses at one medical center told local media that they were not able to wash their hands. Mlimandelela Naramase, a spokesman for Johannesburg's mayor, explained an initial problem at a key pump station occurred on March 3rd after a power outage from a lightning strike. The water problems come amid issues with the nation's electricity supply. South Africa has been mired in an energy crisis for more than a decade, but it has accelerated over the past year, with the country experiencing almost daily scheduled blackouts, sometimes for as long as 10 hours a day. This is also not the first time the city has been without water. The city experienced regular shortages last year. Ndamase acknowledged Johannesburg's water system is plagued by other long-term problems.
The city does accept that there are challenges with regards to aged infrastructure, the maintenance of infrastructure, and also the need to roll out new infrastructure throughout the city.
But many have blamed authorities for what they say is incompetence. On Wednesday, Nombusu Shabalala, a spokesperson for Johannesburg Water, acknowledged that there had been human error too.
Technical teams discovered a bulk supplier valve had been closed, thus restricting supply into the system. The valve has since been opened, and this has assisted with building some capacity.
Anya du Plessis, an associate professor and water expert at the University of South Africa, said ineptitude, deficiency of transparency and accountability, as well as little to no political will, had exacerbated the water crisis.
The rapid escalation and exacerbation of the city of Johannesburg water woes can be attributed to a dysfunctional and inept municipality, the lack of necessary skilled personnel, as well as the lack of financial resources or even non-investment into the maintenance of dilapidated water infrastructure.
Water tankers have been set up across the city, though Johannesburg Water says a majority of its systems are now in recovery. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Al-Shabaab affiliated websites and social media accounts continue to operate and publish the group's messages and statements despite relentless Somali government efforts to close them down. Adam Hapley is the executive director of Tech Against Terrorism, a not-for-profit organization based in London that focuses on disrupting the use of the internet by militants, including Al-Shabaab. He tells Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service that Al-Shabaab is one of the most sophisticated actors in terms of the ways that it uses the internet to share its material.
We have some technology that we've developed called the Terrorist Content Analytics Platform, which is designed to detect and alert terrorist content. And in any given week, around 20 to 25% of the content we find on the internet has likely been created by Al-Shabaab. And what Al-Shabaab does is it uses very large platforms and niche smaller platforms to host content. So what we're finding is that Al-Shabaab are trying very hard to have their material on Facebook, on Twitter, on Telegram, but also behind the scenes they're sharing this material on fairly obscure platforms that are used to evade content moderation from the larger platforms. We're also finding that Al-Shabaab have a number of what we call terrorist-operated websites. And these are websites that have been set up and bought and are run by terrorists to share material. And increasingly what we're finding is that terrorists, including Al-Shabaab, are using Telegram and their own websites increasingly. And this is extremely difficult to counter because Telegram often doesn't remove material particularly quickly, and where websites are concerned, it takes an awfully long time to understand where these sites are hosted and how they can be disrupted.
And who are the target of their materials, their output?
For the most part, the intended audience, we believe, is local and regional. And most of the materials are designed with local readers in mind. However, another factor at play here is that terrorist groups will often try to outperform with one another or compete with one another or to show that they're powerful or that they're having effect. So the purpose of terrorist propaganda is both projecting power domestically, but also projecting power internationally and regionally within the terrorist ecosystem, if that makes sense. And what we know about Al-Shabaab is that they have various connections with other terrorist groups, and the extent to which they're able to show that they exist, that they're having the impact that they intend, is a secondary objective of this material.
And regarding the impact, tell me the type of materials they are sharing, how dangerous, how successful are they in reaching their targets?
In some content that we're seeing is broad in scope. So it can range anything from reports about attacks and executions and bombings, all the way through to perhaps more subtle content relating to governance and political grievances that populations might have. So the type of content that Al-Shabaab creates and shares is pretty broad, and is a broad spectrum of material that you'd expect from a sophisticated terrorist group. And Al-Shabaab is, at least in terms of the way it uses the internet, one of the leading terrorist groups.
Adam Hartley is the executive director of Tech Against Terrorism. He was speaking with Harold Maruf of VOA Somali Service. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill on Wednesday that would force short video app TikTok, used by about 170 million Americans, to separate from its Chinese owner, ByteDance, or face a ban. But as VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, the bill faces significant criticism about restriction of free speech and may not pass in the U.S. Senate.
After years of concern about data privacy on the popular social media app, U.S. lawmakers took a key step Wednesday, calling for TikTok to separate from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance.
Today, we send a clear message that we will not tolerate our adversaries weaponizing our freedoms against us.
With significant bipartisan support, the bill addresses concerns TikTok is a national security threat.
Americans need to ask themselves whether they want to give the Chinese government the ability to control access to their data, whether they want to give the Chinese government the ability to control the information they get through the recommendation algorithm, and whether they want to give the Chinese government the ability to leverage the data.
The bill is passed. TikTok has denied those allegations, calling the House bill a ban. The bill's co-sponsors push back against that claim.
Our intention is for TikTok to continue to operate, but not under the control of the Chinese Communist Party.
China condemned the vote Tuesday.
The U.S. has not found any evidence of TikTok threatening national security. It has never stopped going after TikTok.
And many U.S. lawmakers and civil liberties groups say singling out the app is unfair and limits Americans' rights to free speech.
Any ban on TikTok is not just banning the freedom of expression. You are literally causing huge harm to our national economy.
The TikTok legislation has revived the debate over data privacy and personal freedoms.
There are bigger issues taking away from the American life than TikTok. I mean, people can't afford groceries and we're concerned about a social media app.
Security for all of the platforms are just, they're under scrutiny right now, and I think for good reason. I don't have a lot of trust in the platforms and in the information that's provided these days. I'm just very concerned about the authenticity.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said committees would consider the bill, which could face significant legal challenges.
The U.S. government would have a very, very difficult job of convincing a court that this ban is both narrowly tailored enough to advance this government interest of data privacy, but then also that there are no less restrictive measures that the government could have taken.
President Joe Biden has said he will sign the bill into law if it passes the U.S. Senate. The Biden campaign joined TikTok earlier this year to reach out to younger voters. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
And that's it for this Thursday, March 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington, saying, have a great day, and please be safe, whatever you do.
Around
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-Minute VOA Newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.